Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the effort to send more federal money aimed at paying for energy costs to places where it could be used for cooling.
And a local author's new book explores the dissolution of identity that often accompanies addiction and grief.
But first, Arizona lawmakers and the governor recently approved a new state budget, which closed a combined deficit of roughly $1.4 billion for the fiscal year that ended on June 30th and the new one that starts today. This isn't the only state that's been dealing with shortfalls this year, nor is Arizona the only state in which the size of the state workforce has become an issue. Governor Hobbs this spring ordered what essentially amounts to a hiring freeze for state employees. California and Massachusetts have taken similar steps. I talked more about this earlier with Reed Wilson, founder and editor of Pluribus News, which covers state legislatures across the country. And we started with what Wilson is seeing nationwide when it comes to the sizes of state governments.
So we've seen a couple of states recently begin to make cuts or impose hiring freezes on state-level employment. California is going through a real budget crunch right now. So they've frozen hiring at about 10,000 jobs across the state. Massachusetts is doing something of the same thing, implementing a hiring freeze, similar to what Governor Hobbs is doing in Arizona, though Governor Hobbs doesn't want to call it a hiring freeze. The interesting thing about this is, you know, this comes at the end of many years of boom times for states. After the pandemic or during the pandemic, one of the things the federal government did was they pumped a huge amount of money into states so that states wouldn't have to lay off the workers who were suddenly essential in running government services that were doing things like pandemic prevention, pandemic response, and even just the basic functionings of government. And that is a contrast to what we saw 10 years ago, longer than that, 15 years ago, in the wake of the Great Recession, when so many states had to lay off so many workers that in and of itself contributed to sort of the long tail of the recession last time around.
Did states end up hiring those workers back? Or when we're talking about, you know, potential layoffs or hiring freezes, is that coming from a smaller state government to begin with?
The level of state employees are pretty much even with what they were, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Okay.
The state workforce has not grown substantially in the intervening time, but it also hasn't grown beyond what the government was back then. So, you know, in a 15-year period, you would expect more jobs to be created as government gets bigger just across the country. We're really basically at parity with where we were 15 years ago.
Is it safe to call this a pretty predictable thing for states to do when they are going through budget deficits to sort of look inward and say, okay, how can we save a little bit of money by affecting the size and the scope of state government?
Yeah, this is one of the easiest things that governments can turn to save money. Effectively, stopping the hiring freeze is the way to save money, right? You're not letting employees go, but maybe you're not filling the jobs that have gone vacant. Now, there are two sort of variables here that states are having to deal with. One, I'd say broadly positive, one broadly negative. The positive one is that government's going through a pretty substantial streamlining right now as we begin to consider, as a lot of states begin to consider, how they can use AI, artificial intelligence, to streamline some of the jobs that for, you know, decades or centuries humans have done. On the other hand, we're going through a period where the shape of the government workforce itself is changing. And that's because for, you know, the last several decades, the people who have held government jobs are largely members of the baby boom generation. Those people are at or near retirement age. And so tens of thousands of government workers across the country are retiring every month, which means that there are these new open positions for either for people who are, you know, younger folks who are coming into the workforce, who may not see government as attractive as their parents or grandparents once did. And at the same time, you're going through this brain drain where so many people who've held these government jobs are suddenly losing or suddenly retiring and leaving the stage. So on one hand, government has an opportunity to get a lot more efficient. On the other hand, they're losing a lot of the brain power that's been developed over the course of the baby boom generation's working career.
Yeah, in addition to the brain drain, it sounds like you're describing a great loss of institutional knowledge of how government works and maybe what has been tried in the past and what's worked and what hasn't.
Yeah, and on the other hand here, there's also a problem with the fact that government salaries just don't keep up with the private workforce. We know that every industry in America faces a workforce challenge right now. There aren't enough people to be waiters or cops or teachers or pretty much any industry in the country is having the same kind of workforce challenge. Government salaries don't grow as fast as those private sector salaries do. So the government is having a hard time filling those jobs, even if they're more entry-level positions. There simply aren't as many members of the millennial generation, members of Gen Z, who find government service attractive and lucrative because the private sector is just paying more.
Are you expecting to see more states take these kinds of steps in the not-too-distant future?
Yeah, I do. One of the things that we've seen in the last few years, during the boom times, many states cut taxes, income taxes and property taxes. The boom times are starting to wane. And so even in the states that aren't California or Arizona or Massachusetts, we're starting to see people put holds on tax cuts. Well, maybe we'll do that next year. Maybe we'll delay this tax cut for a few months or a few years. That is sort of a precursor to me that tells me that their budget situation isn't fantastic and that they may need to consider things like cutting the workforce or freezing hiring in the not too distant future.
Understanding that there are all sorts of variables and, different states are putting hiring freezes in different departments or agencies, what kind of impact does this kind of move have on people who rely on the services that state governments provide?
Yeah, that is going to be the longer tail and the one that that states are going to try to solve through things like AI and government efficiencies. You can imagine that there are a number of states these days that have tried to streamline the process for, say, going to the DMV. If there are things that you can do online instead of standing in line and waiting for your number to be called, those sort of basic interactions between citizens and government are the ones that are going to be challenged when workforces shrink or are frozen. But they're also the ones that can be most improved by new technology that governments are only now beginning to understand the implications, the ramifications of.
What are you hearing from budget officials and state officials around the country about how long sort of these non-boom times might be lasting and maybe when hiring freezes might be lifted or, state governments might begin hiring people again?
Yeah, so the non-boom times are here to stay. I mean, it was the pandemic was unique in the amount of money that states found themselves with, both because of the stronger than expected economy and because of the amount of money that the feds sent down to the state level. So boom times are not normal. What we're headed back into is a sort of more normal time where states are going to be breaking even or losing a little bit of money or gaining a little bit of money here and there. They're not going to see the mammoth tax receipts and the mammoth influx of money from the feds that has been unusual in the last few years. What is much more likely is that government's going to grow at a slower clip for the long term, unless we run into a recession, in which case you could start to see governments shrink. I think the big takeaway for me from the pandemic era, though, is that the federal government and state governments realized that there are so many Americans employed in governments at all level that by shedding thousands or tens of thousands of those jobs, you make the consequence of a recession even worse. So it behooves the states and the federal government to make sure that those employees keep their jobs so that the overall economy can improve faster.
All right. That is Reed Wilson, founder and editor of Pluribus News. Reed, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, as the heat gets deadlier here in Phoenix, federal dollars meant to help low-income households pay for energy is largely not going to help Arizona families keep their homes cool in the summer. Instead, that money mostly goes to help families in other parts of the country keep their homes warm in the winter. It's called the Low-Income Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, and the imbalance is nothing new. In fact, Politico found that about 5.3 million households in the U.S. got heating assistance in the last two decades. The number that got cooling, just 635,000. It's a problem that Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs has noticed as well. Earlier this year, she wrote a letter to Congress asking them to fix what she called, quote, the long-standing unequal distribution of the program. Our co-host, Lauren Gilger, spoke more about this with Patricia Solis, executive director of the Knowledge Exchange for Resilience at Arizona State University, which put together an extensive report for the governor on extreme heat preparedness in Arizona after last summer's record heat.
It really is true that on the whole, the latest numbers that I have seen, which I believe were from last year in 2023, about five times more funding nationally goes for helping people with their bills to pay for heating their homes during cold season than goes for paying bills for air conditioning and cooling people's homes. So it definitely is disproportionate. Some of that is because of the way that the allocation has been made. You know, the formula at the beginning was really for that purpose in the 1970s to help people with, you know, the high fossil fuel bills for heating. And so it really hasn't evolved a whole lot. There have been a couple of adjustments over the years, but, you know, the criticism from the state leadership is not out of line with the realities that it is disproportionately going to states for paying for heating.
Right. So do you agree that there should sort of be a reanalysis of not just this program, but programs like this, just thinking about the heat as, you know, for example, an emergency situation or, you know, something that requires FEMA's help or something that qualifies for a good amount of help from LIHEAP? It sounds like we're at a moment when maybe we need to shift our point of view on the heat and what it means.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons why I think this focus on the LIHEAP program is a good one is because it does work. There's just not enough of it. So the problem is, you know, it's a federal block grant program. So it goes to the states, but the states in the South and in the Southwest are actually getting much lower than their share. If you look at what the actual energy burden is now, as we're getting into hotter and hotter summers. So that's what I think the concern is about. Arizona in particular only receives about 0.4% of the national allocation. And if you say, well, there's 50 states and that should be about 2% if you don't account for like eligible population, if you look just at a basic state by state allocation as a block grant. So, you know, I think that there is some concern about making sure that the allocations are fair, but also we just need more of them. And they do work in the sense of we have an infrastructure in place to distribute them. They are going to the households who need them. There's just not enough to go around.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I know you've looked at this issue of cooling solutions in our state much more broadly and made many recommendations to the governor's office about what might be at the top of that list, what might be priorities we can focus on. LIHEAP is one of them and rethinking that. What are some other solutions that you think we really need to take a closer look at here?
Yes, indeed. One of our recommendations was that the Office of the Governor does look at this LIHEAP program and try to track it better. But, you know, there are some gaps in the way that LIHEAP can get distributed just because there is an income eligibility program. And there might be people who are households in need that are not actually eligible for LIHEAP for various reasons. Mm-hmm. People who live in homes that are not eligible for the utility assistance. For example, people who live in mobile manufactured housing may or may not be direct customers of the utilities. So it's much harder for them to access sometimes. And maybe their household income just might be above that threshold, but they're on a fixed income and their homes need cooling. And then there are some other programs which will help people with their energy efficiencies. But sometimes it's just a matter of keeping people cool and comfortable and the thermal comfort, right? So you could pay the same amount. Right now you have to pay, you know, $300 or $400 to just keep it at, you know, 78 degrees or something. But if you had some weatherization assistance, you might still end up paying about that same amount, only you'd be able to keep your home a little bit cooler and a little bit safer, especially for people who might have health issues.
Yeah. A big part of this, and I know you talked about this in your report as well, is working with the federal government or even the private sector, right? Like partnerships that can address these kinds of issues in a broader way, in a bigger way, with more money. Is that an important part of this?
Yeah, I think we need to invest more in those things that are working well to reach more eligible households and expand the eligibility, because, you know, heat really does affect a lot of households and not just the poorest. I mean, we all have to find ways to cope with the heat. And I think that more investment to the things that are working is good, but I think we need to do things in innovative ways. And some of our report recommendations is trying to capture that. For example, some of the limitations on expanding these are not just the dollars, but the workforce, which I think is a positive thing for Arizona to think about. How can we expand our workforce in ways that allow us to be more heat resilient? How can we improve housing and not just the utility infrastructure, but better housing and housing security? So if you think about it as a whole, Arizona can invest in its workforce in terms of, you know, energy, especially renewable energy, housing, housing security, healthcare, HVAC expertise, as well as housing retrofits, right? And this whole weatherization, which I think is one of the reasons why, even if we had a lot more funding, we would still need to make sure and develop the workforce to deliver those services that we need.
Yeah, you have to have people to do the jobs. Let me ask you lastly about the moment that we're in. Like, do you think that there is beginning to be, not just here in Arizona, but nationwide and maybe even worldwide, a change, a shift in the way that we think about heat and heat preparedness and sort of a rethinking prompting some of these changes that you're recommending? Are we on the road?
Yes, I think that, you know, a lot of people around here have given this a lot of thought over many, many years, and we have evolved our thinking over time. But you're right that there seems to be a kind of moment here for heat and extreme heat, because we are starting to see increased frequency of heat waves, increased duration, other places in the country that have not necessarily experienced this kind of a threat are now starting to see these kinds of things. And so I do think we're coming up on a threshold level of attention and awareness. And you mentioned earlier FEMA, you know, despite the fact that heat kills more people than any other disaster combined in the United States, it is not considered one of the Stafford Act disasters.
Right.
It does require a different kind of mindset to think about how to prepare. It's not like a hurricane or floods where you can kind of see it coming. You know, the heat wave looks like a sunny day.
Yeah.
But we know how dangerous here that it can be. And we need to prepare. We need to watch out for our neighbors. And we need to do a lot more.
All right. We'll leave it there. That is Patricia Solis, Executive Director of the Knowledge Exchange for Resilience at Arizona State University, joining us to talk more about cooling solutions and LIHEAP. Patricia, thank you for coming on. Thank you for explaining this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, an author spent years working on his memoir, but the day after he sent the manuscript to publishers, his brother passed away.
That same day, I withdrew all my submissions to agents and started rewriting the book.
We'll hear from the author of Bones Worth Breaking.
But first, last week's debate between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump has led to a lot of discussion about whether Biden is up for the job and whether Democrats should look to replace him at the top of the ticket. It's also led to a lot of discussion about the number of lies Trump told and whether or not he should have been called out on them. But the debate has also led to some concern overall for the country. Phil Boas, columnist for the Arizona Republic, wrote about the future of American leadership in the current climate. He joins me along with Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor at the Republic, to talk about this. And Phil, let me start with you about the column you wrote. And you looked at the debate through the lens of what it meant for the country. And in your mind, it was not necessarily such a good thing.
Yeah, you know, when I looked at this, I didn't see a victory for any of the candidates. What I saw was American decline. And I was thinking about, if you could go back 40 years and you took the Americans who watched the Reagan-Mondale debate. And immediately after that, in 1984, you gave them a look at the future and you let them watch the presidential debate that would happen 40 years from now between a guy named Donald Trump and Joe Biden, who they knew back then. They knew Trump as well. But if they could watch that, they would have just been appalled at what they saw. It was appalling. It was a symbol of American decline. And we don't have the luxury to be this silly and trivial. We have real threats that are gathering on the horizon, and this country has to sober up very quickly.
Elvia, did you see this the same way? Did you see the debate as a sign of American decline?
Yes, on so many levels. I mean, I don't think there should be any disagreement here, not only from the performances of the candidates. So you have one, Joe Biden, who, you know, clearly it was a brutal night for him. I mean, there's no denying what happened there. I mean, he just couldn't do it. I mean, and you could see his agility and mental decline right in front of our eyes. So that was very painful to see. On the other hand, you have another candidate who was much better at delivering lies, essentially. And that's what is the decline. I mean, with Donald Trump doing better performance wise, but, you know, spewing one lie after another, and then with a format that validated all that, you know, validated President Biden's mental decline and also validated their lies without calling them out right on the spot.
Well, so, Phil, you referenced the Reagan-Mondale debates of 40 years ago and how, you know, how what happened last week did not look like that. But I've got to ask, like the last few cycles, at least, people have been saying, you know, you don't get much out of the debates. You know, 4 years ago, a lot of folks were saying nothing came out of the debates, you know, between, and even you think about 8 years ago, between former President Trump and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, like the debates, it seems recently have become more about memorable one-liners and, you know, attacks against the other person, not so much a great debate of ideas. So I'm curious, what about last week's signaled decline when some of the others in recent cycles haven't?
Well, decline has been happening for a while. And so presidential debates have been getting further and further away from ideals and policy and turning more into this sort of modern smash mouth that we have today. It's tribal and it's just going for each other's throats. And I found it amazing that there were Republicans who thought Trump did great in that debate. Trump was terrible in that debate. Trump was one superlative after another. He stretched the truth. He lied, you know, made bald-faced lies about all kinds of things. And, you know, and the man can't command facts. He is not literate in any way. And it was just a mess. And my point is we can't do that now because we have adversaries out there who are incredibly dangerous. And that's why I started that piece with a quote by Robert Gates, who is a defense secretary for both W. Bush and also for Obama for a while. And he said that the United States now at this moment confronts graver threats to its security than it has in decades and perhaps ever. And we are in a cold war right now with China. And China is not like the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, it was an economic basket case, and it was a nuclear power. It was a nuclear superpower. China is a military nuclear superpower, and it's also an economic superpower. And it is a real threat to our future and our way of life. And the threat of a great power's war is around the corner. And we've got to get serious as a country. And it's not going to happen with the two guys we've got right now. So it was very disturbing to watch.
Well, so, Phil, given the fact that one of those two will either become again or continue to be president come January, what does all that mean? And how do we, as you say, sober up, get serious about this, given that what we saw last week, one of those two people will be commander in chief?
Well, the good news here is that underneath the president's are a lot of serious people. The Council on Foreign Relations, launched a China initiative last week with a program with a lot of smart, literate, highly intellectual people who are speaking intelligently about the big issues that confront us in ways that Biden and Trump are incapable of doing. And so there is a layer beneath them of smart people who know that we have to be concerned about what is on the horizon, and they're talking about it in intelligent ways. But it is very troubling to know that whoever the person on the at the top is going to be sort of disabled in a way. They're just not, they don't have the capabilities to make important decisions that will have to be made from the Oval Office.
Yeah, Elvie, I'm curious what, in your mind, this all means for American foreign policy, for American defense here, given, as Phil said, you know, this country, as Robert Gates said, is facing the greatest threat it's faced in quite a while.
You know, that's it. That's the bottom line of everything. I mean, not only foreign threats that we're facing, domestic as well, right? So, and we are a very huge country and incredibly complex. So you do need a commander-in-chief who is going to be at the top of his or her game, and we just don't have that. So I do believe that we are in a crisis mode as a nation, domestically and again internationally, and the kind of debate that we're having, I mean, to Phil's point, I mean, it's so devastating on so many levels. Not only the debate performance, which has become just an entertainment TV show. Then you go back to what Phil was saying. You know, clearly Biden has a lot of competent people around him, and it begins with us as well. Something that we haven't discussed, the three of us, is our responsibility as media, right? I mean, I don't know what has been more brutal to me, watching the debate or watching the debaters talk about it later.
Elvia, is it too naive, I guess, to think that at some point presidential debates could go back to what they were? I'm not even talking like Lincoln Douglas, but, you know, Phil referenced the Reagan Mondale debates, you know, from the early 80s. Is it possible to get back to that, where the candidates aren't really just trying to attack each other and score one liner points, but to actually express what they think about issues and what they'd like to do?
I wish I knew, because it speaks to the state of journalism as well. You know, as I mentioned, it's an entertainment show. That's all it is. And we just witness that. So it's up to us, to the American people, to see what kind of media we want, what kind of candidates, the quality of the candidates to begin with. So, and it's not just TV, you know, but so right now, unfortunately, I wish I knew, you know, what the future holes in terms of presidential debates. Right now, it's just not looking great.
Yeah, Phil, I mean, obviously, this is a very different ecosystem, political ecosystem, media ecosystem, than it was, you know, even a decade or so ago. Is it possible to go back to a time when candidates discussed issues, maybe got a few political, you know, personal jabs in there as well? But, you know, we left the debates really having a sense of what the candidates thought about particular issues and what they would do.
Yeah, I think this is a temporary departure from American seriousness. I think we'll get back, because we'll have to, because the Chinese are going to force us to be much more serious about how we run this country and how we conduct our politics.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Phil Boas, columnist with the Arizona Republic, and Elvia Diaz, the paper's editorial page editor. Thanks to you both for your time and your insights. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Well, there is plenty of electoral intrigue unfolding around the world this week. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewen in London. Jonathan, let's start this week with a look at the general election that's coming up this Thursday in the UK. What is the latest?
Well, it's been almost 6 weeks since a damp Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announced the election in the pouring rain in Downing Street. Since then, the opposition Labour Party's polling lead has barely moved, with the party around 20 points ahead of the governing Conservatives. Unless something unexpected happens between now and Thursday, it looks as though Labour's Keir Starmer will be Prime Minister by the end of the week, with what looks like it could be a very substantial parliamentary majority. Now, looking at polling averages since the start of the campaign, both Labour and the Conservatives have lost around 2 or 3 percentage points in the polls, which has been soaked up from Labour by the Green Party and the Liberal Democrats, and for the Conservatives by the Reform Party. That's a party founded by Nigel Farage, who played a pivotal role in persuading Britain to vote for Brexit. Reform is essentially a rebranded Brexit party and has sought to make immigration a key topic in this election. Mr. Farage is standing in the Clacton parliamentary constituency, where it looks as though he may win, though his party faced controversy late last week when it emerged that people canvassing for him there had made homophobic remarks, described Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in racist terms, and advocated for soldiers to shoot at migrants crossing the English Channel. They were condemned by Nigel Farage and swiftly removed from the campaign, although Mr. Farage also claimed the undercover filming of those events may have been a setup, something Channel 4 News strongly denies.
Well, a lot of converging factors there. What have been some of the most significant moments in the election campaign?
Well, I think early on when Rishi Sunak chose to skip the main international events at the D-Day 80th anniversary commemorations in France and came back to the UK early is probably the most memorable moment for many voters. He was heavily criticised for that. Nigel Farage choosing to come back to lead the Reform Party is another significant moment, which may end up costing the Conservatives a lot of seats. And then over the past couple of weeks or so, there's been a fairly significant betting scandal, which has engulfed the Conservatives, where a number of candidates have been suspended when it came to light they may have bet on the unexpectedly early date of the election. The allegation is that they used inside information to try and make some money, and there's now an investigation by the Gambling Commission here, but it took a very long time after the issue coming to light for Rishi Sunak to suspend the candidates involved. Now, the betting scandal hasn't been completely restricted to the Conservatives, though, because the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, immediately suspended one of his own candidates last week when it came to light that he had bet against himself to win in his own parliamentary seat, or the one he was running for. So it's going to be very interesting, though, to see how everything plays out once the results start coming in on Thursday night.
Yes. Well, speaking of results coming in, this weekend, France goes to the polls for the second round of their parliamentary election. Remind us why President Emmanuel Macron chose to go to the country for this snap vote.
Emmanuel Macron had no need to call National Assembly elections for another 3 years, but an hour after his alliance was trounced in European parliamentary elections by the far-right National Rally Party of Jordan Bardella and Marine Le Pen, early last month, Mr. Macron went on TV to call an election. He'd apparently been thinking about doing this for months, but it came out of the blue for even his closest colleagues. Now, keep in mind that his own job is not on the line here, but Emmanuel Macron clearly wanted to break a logjam after his failure to secure an absolute majority in the National Assembly in June 2022. The first round of voting yesterday eliminated any candidate who failed to secure the support of 12.5% of locally registered voters, and then anyone who exceeds that goes to the second round next weekend. Those securing 50% of the vote were elected in the first round.
Yes, the first round results are now in. What do they tell us about which way this election is headed?
Well, the first thing to note is that it looks as though Emmanuel Macron's gamble to call this snap poll has backfired spectacularly. The far-right National Rally has emerged with around 33% of the vote, meaning they could win 230 to 280 seats next Sunday. That's up from their current tally of just 88. Oof. The upper end of that projection could put them within shouting distance of an overall majority, for which a party needs 289 seats. The four-party left-wing alliance, New Popular Front, came second with 28% of the vote. That translates to somewhere between 130 and 160 seats. And that meant a crushing third place spot on around 20% of the vote for Emmanuel Macron's centrist alliance Ensemble. Now, that would mean losing more than half of its current 250 seats, ending up with somewhere between 70 and 100. One deputy described it as a total catastrophe. So what remains to be seen next weekend is whether National Rally can command a majority. Its leader, Jordan Bardella, had said he would not try to become prime minister unless his party does achieve that. Candidates have until the end of tomorrow to withdraw. And already dozens of left-wing or centrist third-placed candidates have withdrawn to encourage people to vote for someone else, thereby potentially denying National Rally an overall majority. And if National Rally doesn't secure a majority, there would then be quite a lengthy search for a candidate for prime minister, which may result in a period of instability with a parliament opposed to the president's agenda.
Well, just a few more electoral dynamics to look at here. Tomorrow, a new government is being inaugurated in the Netherlands, but it's been a long time since the last election there. What's been going on since then?
It has been a long time. More than 7 months ago, last November, the Dutch went to the polls in a vote in which the far-right populist Geert Wilders came out on top with a quarter of the national vote for his Freedom Party. Prime Minister Mark Rutte remained on in a caretaking capacity, and just last week his appointment was confirmed to be the next head of the NATO military alliance. Back in mid-May, Geert Wilders and three other party leaders finally agreed on a program for government with a coalition made up of Wilders' Freedom Party, the conservative liberal VVD party, the centrist New Social Contract and the Farmer Citizens Movement. But it had been previously agreed that Geert Wilders would not become the prime minister. So negotiations over who should take that role continued for several more weeks. Then at the end of May, it emerged that Dick Schoof, aged 67, would become prime minister. Now, he's a former domestic intelligence chief who has spent his entire career in the civil service and was most recently the top official in the justice ministry. When his appointment was announced, he said that his focus on the rule of law would help him govern the Netherlands. And it's also thought that his experience in the justice ministry may help him to navigate some of the coalition's biggest ambitions. The leaders of the four parties in that governing coalition are not expected to have cabinet roles in the new government, and unusually, the so-called extra-parliamentary cabinet is likely to be made up of ministers who are not in the parliament either, but will have to follow the main terms of the coalition agreement.
So you mentioned the coalition's ambitions. What sort of policies is the coalition seeking to enact?
Well, there are plans for a radical tightening of policy on asylum seekers and immigration. The coalition is seeking to increase natural gas production as well as the relaxation of an array of green regulations. And then there are plans to reintroduce fuel subsidies for farmers in a couple of years' time. Significant investment is also expected in social security and housing as well as defence. Now, ahead of the election, Geert Wilders had put on hold some of his more extreme policies, such as banning the Quran, Islamic schools and mosques. Nevertheless, it looks like it will be quite a different government running the Netherlands to those which voters have been used to.
All right. Well, lots to keep an eye on. As always, the BBC's Jonathan Frewin joining us this Monday morning. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. So, not long ago, author David Martinez went to the bookstore to see where they had shelved his new book, Bones Worth Breaking. And at one store he went to, he found it shelved under religion, and at another, it was in the memoir section. Martinez was not necessarily surprised by this. He knows that his book, which flows back and forth between recollections of his youth as a multiracial Mormon kid, his family's frequent moves, and he and his brother's struggles with substance abuse, is a little hard to categorize. But as Martinez told me recently, so is life. And he wanted to write a book that reflected that. So I began by asking Martinez to read one of my favorite passages from Bones Worth Breaking.
I drive somewhere I don't really need to go just to travel, to hear the music so loud I can do nothing but sing along with all my saudades. I'm never satisfied with where I am because I keep feeling the lack of where I'm not. There's always something else. There's always more people. And yet there's never enough to fill the space of everything left behind.
Thank you. That word, saudades, tell us what that word means.
Yeah, so saudade, it's Portuguese. It doesn't really have a direct translation into English. I mean, you can say, you know, like you miss somebody, but it's not exactly the same thing. It's really more like feeling the absence of somebody.
Yeah.
And I use this in my class a lot, and it comes from Joan Didion, but I write to figure out what I'm thinking. Mm. And it, especially for this book, I think I was writing to figure out, why did my little brother die in prison? Why is it that my family especially, like, won't examine it?
So tell me about you and Mike.
We were extremely close. He died in prison in Tucson about 3 years ago of septic shock. You know, he was 3 years younger than me, and he was one of those kids that would, like, follow me around all over the place. And when he was, like, 8, and I was like, let's say 8, 9, 10, 11, something like that. He wanted, when he bought shoes, he wanted to have the same size shoes as me, even though they made him look like a clown. He wanted to have the same size shoes as me. So as we grew older and as we fell more into destructive behaviors, we we're even closer, you know.
So can I ask you about that? Because this is one of the most heartbreaking and fascinating elements of the book is you both fall into various kinds of substance abuse and addiction. But you, as you make your way through your life, seem to carry it in tandem with going to grad school, becoming a teacher, getting married, all these things. And it seems like he carries it differently.
Mike was very different in me in that he liked the life. He liked, you know, the chaos and the adventures of living in that world of dope, you know? Mm-hmm. And I didn't. I used so that I could be okay.
Was it a way of spending time with him too?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, to that end, I know the original goal with the book was for it to be something you co-wrote with him. So tell me about how that process started.
Yeah. So I'll even take it way back and talk about how the book started in general.
Okay.
It does tie together. So once upon a time.
First line of the book.
Right. I was doing my Master of Fine Art in Creative Writing at University of California, Riverside, the low residency program. And to earn your master's degree, you have to write a thesis, which at the time was a novel for me. And I was like, okay, this has to be it. I have to do this to be a writer. And I'd written this book and I sent it out to a bunch of different agents. And there were a couple people who got back to me and was like, oh, we'd like the full manuscript, but nothing really serious. While that was going on, I got really, really angry. And so I started writing about that. And that kind of like snowballed into the whole first chapter of this book. So I just kept writing and I kept writing all these, you know, I wrote about the Saudade piece in there. I wrote all these different things. And all the while, Mike used to call me about twice a day from prison. And we would talk about the things that I was writing, you know. And so from 2017 to about 2020, I was working on this and I'd given up on the novel. I'd shelved it because a lot of what was in the novel was a fictionalized version of what's in the book. And so this was on it. Like it was better. Mm-hmm. It was better than the novel was going to be.
Yeah.
And so February 2021, I sent it out to a bunch of agents, and March 1st, it was the day after I sent it out to agents, Mike died. That same day, I withdrew all my submissions to agents and started rewriting the book.
So let me get this straight. This journey of this book is first, there was a novel that was a fictionalized version of many of the events in the book.
Yeah.
The second version was a version where you decided to write from a place of truth and memory about these events. And to incorporate Mike, you send that. So you've sent the first version out, gotten crickets. Mm-hmm. You sent the second version out. Then Mike dies. You start the book over a third time.
Yes.
And that is this book.
Yes.
You know, I just have to say that I didn't know the backstory of how many times you had sat down to write this book until this conversation. But it makes me think of another quote from the book, which is where your grandmother is talking about her thumb.
Yeah.
Like she cut the top of it off, I think.
Yeah, she did.
And she says, it was already hurting. I just had to figure out what to do with the pain.
Yeah. We talk about saudade, and I think I was just writing my saudades.
So one could imagine a person writing a memoir about the loss of their brother.
Right.
One could imagine a person writing a memoir about growing up Mormon and never necessarily feeling like you fit in, which is another element in this book.
Yes.
All of these individual things writers have turned into full-length books. But your approach in this book is to not anchor the book in any one of those narratives, but to move organically and intuitively kind of back and forth between all of them. How did you arrive at that approach?
Yeah, that I think it's really sad when we boil ourselves down to one aspect.
Yeah.
You know, I'm ex-Mormon or whatever, and that's it. That's your personality.
Yeah.
Or I'm, you know, in recovery, and that's my whole personality, you know. And I'm not dissing people who go route. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about like me personally. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother is Black and Indigenous. My dad's white. That makes me very mixed, and I would feel wrong dismissing any of those sides of myself.
Well, I can't help thinking also that when you grow up in an extreme church culture like that, there is one narrative that's being forced on you,
right,
to define you.
Right.
And so in a way, leaning into the kind of river of identities that you're constantly moving through is a refutation of that culture.
Yeah, yeah, it absolutely is. And from the time that we were very young, we were pushing against that. Because as a child, you know you're being lied to.
Yeah.
You know? And I didn't like that. I wanted something real, something – and I know that's why Mike got into drugs. I know that's why I did too. It wasn't a good idea, but when you're 9 and 8 and 11 or 9 and 12, you don't have good ideas.
So the idea was like, this is a grown-up thing? Like this is
– Yeah, like this is a grown-up thing, but even more like – it wasn't even that. It was this is something that wounded people do, and we are wounded.
Wow.
I know that was my mindset even then, is that I didn't know why I was wounded. I didn't know why I felt the way that I did, but I know that I was.
It was already hurting. You just had to figure out what to do with the pain.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
I can't help noticing, perhaps in closing, your phone case. Can you tell us what's on the back of your phone case?
Yeah, so I do love Joan Didion, and it is the first line from the White Album, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live."
There you go. David Martinez, author of Bones Worth Breaking, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You know, Mark, I was just thinking, I wish there was some way to listen to all the music that we play on the show, like a mixtape or...
Yeah, maybe like a playlist.
Yeah.
Well, my friend, you are in luck. We have created just that. You can find the 8.5-hour playlist with every song we played on the show last month right on our Spotify account.
That's right, 8.5 hours. And if you're a Decembrists fan, you're really in luck. I mixed in a whole bunch of their songs to my interview with Colin Molloy, including a 19-minute track from their new record.
That is a long track, 19 minutes. Wow.
Really pads out a playlist.
Yes. So the producers say there are a total of 119 songs in this playlist.
Sounds like a prescription for a perfect road trip.
Indeed. If you want to listen, just search KJZZ's The Show on Spotify. And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.